is to be manned by any idle hand on board. The bowman's tasks included warding off floating debris with his iron-tipped pole, calling out warnings of dangers ahead, looking for the best place to cross the river, and watching for sandbars, whirlpools, whatever. On June 8th, the bowman called out, "Pirogue ahead!" The boats tied up at a bank, and the two parties began to exchange information. The three downstream travelers explained that they had been hunting and trapping on the upper Missouri for the past year. Clark estimated that they had about $900 worth of pelts and furs. This was big money in the pre-industrial revolution age, about as profitable a venture as any young, ambitious entrepreneur could find, other than a gold or silver claim. Of course, as always, the men who did the hard part and took the greatest risks got the least reward. The $900 the voyagers got in St. Louis would grow by a factor of 10 by the time the furs reached New York. In China, they were worth 10 times the New York price. From the Indian point of view, the furs were their resources, taken without their permission and without payment. One had to doubt that they would continue to allow white men to trap their creeks and rivers. Even if they did, without trading posts scattered along the Missouri, small parties could hardly hope to be successful. The three men the expedition met on June 8th were out of provisions and powder. Even with a handout from the captains, they were just going to make it back to St. Louis. On June 12th, the bowman again cried out, "Pirogues ahead!" This time, there were two pirogues. One contained furs, the other buffalo grease and tallow. Lewis bought 300 pounds of voyager's grease from the trappers. Whether for food or insect repellent, or both, is unclear. He paid with a chit that could be cashed with Stoddard in St. Louis. The leader of the party was Pierre Dorion, Sr., a 55-year-old Frenchman who had known George Rogers Clark back in Illinois during the Revolutionary War. In 1785, Dorion had settled down with a Yankton Sioux on the Missouri above the Platte. He had a Yankton wife and spoke the language fluently, as well as French and English. Such priceless skills could not be ignored. Lewis and Clark persuaded Dorion, old Dorion in Clark's journal, to return to the Sioux villages with them. They hoped that Dorion could persuade some Sioux chiefs to go to Washington to meet their new father. On June 17th, Clark complained, "The party is much afflicted with boils, and several have the dysentery, which I contribute to the water, which is muddy." The next day, several men had the dysentery, and two-thirds of them with ulcers or boils, some with 8 or 10 of those tumors. Lewis agreed with Clark's diagnosis that the water was to blame. The captains urged the men to dip their cups below the surface when they went for a drink of water. The surface water was full of scum, mud, and debris. If the men dipped deep, they could get cleaner water. The captains were undoubtedly right about the bad effects of the water, but an equal culprit in bringing on the boils and other skin problems was their diet. Only on the rarest of occasions did the party get fresh vegetables, such as watercress, and there was no ripe fruit as yet. Roman legions put vinegar in their drinking water, but Lewis and Clark had taken no such precaution. They and their men were living on meat and cornmeal. The meat was contaminated with bacteria, of whose existence they were unaware. Infected mosquito bites also contributed to their ailments. In camp, ticks and gnats were bad, mosquitoes a plague. They came up in droves, so thick that the men could not keep them out of their eyes, noses, ears, and throats. To escape, men stood in the smoke of the fire and coated their exposed limbs, neck, and face with voyager's grease. On June 26, the expedition completed its westward trek of nearly 400 river miles across the present state of Missouri and arrived at the mouth of the Kansas River. There, they spent nearly 4 days making observations and airing, sunning, and repacking their goods. "The country about the mouth of this river is very fine," Clark wrote about the site of present-day Kansas City. He measured the width of the rivers. The Kansas was 230 yards wide, the Missouri 500. Lewis weighed the water of the two rivers and found the Missouri's to be heavier, meaning it carried more mud. Still, Clark found, "The waters of the Kansas is very disagreeably tasted to me." On the evening of June 28th, the party made ready to push back into the river at dawn. But that night there was a raid on the whiskey supply, serious enough to cause a delay. Alcohol in any form has always been a curse and a necessity to military leaders. Drunkenness causes more discipline and personnel problems than any other cause, but soldiers must have their alcohol. Frederick the Great put it best. If you contemplate some enterprise against the enemy, the commissary must scrape together all of the beer and brandy that can be found so that the army does not lack either, at least during the first few days. In other words, don't run out of booze until there is no turning back. Lewis had bought all the whiskey he felt could be carried without making an unacceptable sacrifice somewhere else, for example in trade goods. The total figure is disputed, but about 120 gallons is generally accepted. The daily ration was one gill. Used at that rate, the whiskey would be gone in 104 days. That could be stretched by watering down the whiskey, but it was still obvious that there was not enough to make it to the Pacific and back. No doubt every man in the party knew exactly how much whiskey was available and how much of it was his by rights. They knew they would run out. It had happened to them before. They could handle it as long as everyone ran out at the same time and no man got a half ounce more than his fair share. Just after midnight, June 28th to 29th, Private John Collins was on guard duty. He tapped a barrel. Just one little sip wouldn't hurt. Just one more. Another. Soon he was drunk. Private Hugh Hall came up. Collins offered him a drink. Hall accepted. Soon they were drunk together. At dawn, the sergeant of the guard put them under arrest, and shortly thereafter, Clark began drawing up court-martial papers. While Clark prepared for the trial, Lewis took advantage of a clear sky and a morning moon. He measured the distance between the sun and the moon's nearest limb 48 times between 7:06 and 8:57 a.m. He faithfully recorded whatever he could, whenever he could, leaving up to experts back east to work out the meaning of the figures. At 11 o'clock a.m., the court convened, agreeable to order. Sergeant Pryor presided, Private John Potts acted as judge advocate, and four privates were members. Sergeant Ordway charged Collins with getting drunk on his post this morning out of whiskey put under his charge as a sentinel, and for suffering Hugh Hall to draw whiskey out of the said barrel intended for the party. Collins pled, "Not guilty!" The court deliberated, then concluded, "Guilty," and sentenced Collins to 100 lashes on his bare back. Hall was charged with taking whiskey out of a keg this morning, which was contrary to all order, rule, or regulation. Having seen what happened to Collins, Hall tried a bit of plea bargaining. Guilty! He was sentenced to receive 50 lashes well laid on. Lewis and Clark approved the sentence and ordered it carried out at 3:30 p.m. It was, with vigor. Clark noted that, "We have always found the men very ready to punish such crimes." Flogging was cruel, but not unusual. Slaveholders had seen it all their lives. Officers in the army saw it done on a regular basis to their own men. In this case, it fit the need perfectly. It allowed the men to let out their anger in a direct, physical way. It caused Collins and Hall great pain. But the expedition didn't lose their services. Both men were at the oars, groaning, but at the oars, that afternoon. After a couple of sleepless nights of tossing and turning, they would be all right. Besides, there was no guardhouse on the boat to lock them up in. Deer to be seen in every direction, and their tracks are as plenty as hogs about a farm, Clark wrote on June 30th. Now headed north, the expedition was entering a near paradise. Clark noted, "Raspberries, purple, ripe, and abundant." On July 4th, the men ushered in the day with the firing of the cannon. Private Joseph Field got bitten by a snake. Captain Lewis treated him with a poultice, probably of Peruvian bark, that drew the poison. At noon, the party pulled ashore at the mouth of a creek of some 15 yards wide, coming out of an extensive prairie on the left's west side. As they ate, the captains questioned the voyagers. No, they knew no name for the creek. The captains thereupon named it, their second experience in bestowing a name. They called it Independence Creek. Most of the rivers had French names. The first named by Clark was Cupboard Creek on June 3, 1804. The expedition pulled over for the night at the site of an old Kansas Indian town. "We camped in the plain," Clark wrote, "one of the most beautiful plains I ever saw, open and beautifully diversified with hills and valleys, all presenting themselves to the river covered with grass and a few scattering trees, a handsome creek meandering through." The captains ordered an extra gill distributed. As they sipped their portions, they took in their surroundings and were quite overwhelmed. The country was covered with a sweet and nourishing grass, interspersed with copses of trees, spreading their lofty branches over pools, springs, or brooks of fine water. Groups of shrubs covered with the most delicious fruit is to be seen in every direction, and nature appears to have exerted herself to beautify the scenery by the variety of flowers delicately and highly flavored raised above the grass, which strikes and perfumes the sensation and amuses the mind. At sunset, the men again fired the cannon. It was the first ever 4th of July celebration west of the Mississippi River. Perhaps the captains grew philosophical under the influence of the whiskey, as happens to earnest young men carrying heavy responsibilities who find themselves in the Garden of Eden, as full dark comes on and the campfire burns down, on their nation's birthday. Clark's last journal entry that day: "So magnificent a scenery," here follow several words that Clark later crossed out, "in a country thus situated, far removed from the civilized world, to be enjoyed by nothing but the buffalo, elk, deer, and bear, in which it abounds, and savage Indians." Possibly the captains puzzled over why God had created such a place and failed to put Virginians in it, or put it in Virginia. On July 8, there was an Indian scare, a fire on the east bank. All hands went on alert, but nothing came of it. On the night of July 11th to 12th, Private Alexander Willard went to sleep on his post. Ordway found him and turned him in. The offense was one of the most serious possible, punishable by death according to the regulations. The captains themselves constituted the court, rather than privates as in Collins's case. Ordway charged Willard with lying down and sleeping on his post whilst a sentinel. Willard pled, "Guilty of lie down, and not guilty of going to sleep." The captains conferred. After considering the evidence, they found Willard guilty on both counts. They sentenced him to 100 lashes each day for 4 days, beginning that evening at sunset. One shudders at the thought of Willard's back after the 4th day. One shudders at the thought of what might have happened had a roving band of Sioux come up while Willard was sleeping on guard duty. On July 21st, some 600 miles and 68 days upstream from Wood River, the expedition reached the mouth of the Platte River. This was a milestone. To go past the mouth of the Platte was the Missouri Riverman's equivalent of crossing the equator. It also meant entering a new ecosystem and Sioux territory. The expedition stopped so the captains could make the usual measurements. Lewis wrote a 500-word description of the Platte, that fabulous river that makes its way from the Rockies across modern Nebraska to the Missouri, running a mile wide and an inch deep, just bursting with animal and plant life. What most impressed Lewis was the immense quantity of sand the Platte emptied into the Missouri and the velocity of the current. He measured, as he always did. Whereas on the Mississippi, below St. Louis, a vessel would float at 4 miles an hour, and on the Missouri from 5.5 to 7, depending, on the Platte that vessel would make at least 8 miles an hour, assuming it never ran aground, which it would at every bend or sandbar. Lewis also made his celestial observations. The next morning he wrote a 1,000-word description of the instruments he was using, how he was using them, what he was measuring, and so forth. It seems Lewis wanted to be as sure as he could that someone someday would take all his figures and make some sense out of them. On July 30th, Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis and myself walked in the prairie on the top of the bluff and observed the most beautiful prospects imaginable. This prairie is covered with grass about 10 or 12 inch high. There were swans in a nearby pond. Great quantities of catfish were caught that evening." Private Joseph Field killed and brought in to Lewis a badger. Lewis wrote that, "This is a singular animal not common to any part of the United States," and went on with a description of its weight, teeth, eyes, and so on. Then he skinned and stuffed the badger to send back to Jefferson. This was the first time he had put into practice the taxidermic skills Jefferson had taught him. The badger was not new to science. A specimen sent from Canada to Europe in 1778 had been technically described. The expedition had already discovered and Lewis had described two animals new to science, the eastern wood rat and the plains horned toad. So far, 640 miles up the river, the party had not seen an Indian. All the river tribes were out on the prairie, hunting buffalo. Chapter 13. Entering Indian Country. August 1804. August 1st was Clark's 34th birthday. To mark the occasion, I ordered a saddle of fat venison, an elk fleece, and a beaver tail to be cooked and a dessert of cherries, plums, raspberries, currants, and grapes of a superior quality. Taking note of the flora and fauna in this wonderland the expedition was entering, Clark noted, "What a field for a botanist and a naturalist!" No American, not even the professional naturalists, such as John James Audubon and Alexander Wilson, had ever seen anything to surpass it. Lewis was fully aware of the magnitude of the discoveries, and greatly excited by the opportunity to be the one to note and describe plants and animals new to science. He spent hours examining and describing his finds. On August 5th, for example, he killed a bull snake. He measured its length from nose to tail, 5 feet 2 inches, its circumference, 4.5 inches, the number of scuta on its belly, 221, and tail, 53, its color, spots, and other distinctive markings. That afternoon, he killed 2 aquatic birds he had previously observed but been unable to obtain. They were leased terns. He used 1,000 words to describe the specimens, including weight, 1.5 ounces, length, 7.5 inches, markings, and so on. He recorded, "The tail has 11 feathers, the outer of which are 1 inch longer than those in the center, gradually tapering inwards. The largest or outer feather is 2.75 inches, that of the shortest 1.75 inches. This bird is very noisy when flying, which it does extremely swift. It has 2 notes, one like the squawking of a small pig, only on rather a high key, the other kit-ti, kit-ti, as near as letters can express the sound." As the men laboriously moved the keelboat upriver, Lewis, in the cabin, weighed and measured and examined and recorded. He took his responsibilities seriously, but he had a lot of fun doing it, and he had a never-flagging sense of wonder and delight at seeing something new. On August 8th, one of the bowmen called back to Lewis, who was working in the cabin. The captain looked up to see a blanket of white coming down the river. He went to the bow to stare down into the water. The keelboat and the white whatever it was came together. On close examination, it turned out to be a sea of white feathers, over 3 miles long and 70 yards wide. The boat rounded a bend. Ahead was a large sandbar at the foot of a small island. It was entirely covered with white pelicans, preening themselves in their summer molt. To Lewis, the number of birds was incredible. They appeared to cover several acres of ground. The mosquitoes were so thick that he could not keep them out of his eyes to take an aimed shot, so he fired his rifle at random into the mass and collected a specimen, which he then weighed, measured, and described. He was astonished to find that the pouch could hold 5 gallons of water. The white pelican was not new to science. Lewis had not seen one before, but he knew enough about it to call it a bird of clime that wintered on the coasts of Florida and the borders of the Gulf of Mexico. That knowledge came from book learning. He had never been to Florida or the Gulf of Mexico. On August 12th, at 5 o'clock p.m., what Clark called a prairie wolf appeared on the bank and barked at the passing keelboat. The captains had not previously seen this animal or read anything about it, so they went ashore to collect a specimen. But, Clark sadly noted, "We could not get him." The animal was a coyote. Lewis and Clark were the first Americans to see one. The captain set a precedent. Millions of Americans who came after have also failed in their attempt to kill the coyote. On August 18th, while waiting for an Indian delegation to approach, Lewis took 12 soldiers to a fishing pond used by the Otoes. The party caught 490 catfish and upward of 300 fish of 9 other species. Beyond flora and fauna, Lewis studied and described the soil and minerals of the area. He was not so good a mineralogist as a botanist. One mineral experiment almost cost him his life. On August 22nd, along with some copperas and alum, he found a substance that appeared to be arsenic or cobalt. Clark recorded, "Captain Lewis, in proving the quality of those minerals, was near poisoning himself by the fumes and tastes of the unknown substance." Lewis took some of Rush's pills to work off the effects of the arsenic. By August 23rd, the expedition was almost at the 98th meridian, the generally agreed-upon eastern border of the Great Plains of North America. The sense of being in a Garden of Eden was strong. There were fat deer and elk and beaver and other species in numbers scarcely conceivable. That afternoon, Lewis sent Private Joseph Field on a hunt. A few hours later, Field came rushing down the bluff to the bank and hollered out to the boat to come ashore. When it did, he breathlessly announced that he had killed a buffalo. The buffalo was the quintessential animal of the North American continent, the symbol of the Great Plains. More than any other animal save the beaver, the magnet that drew men to the West. It was not new to science, but of the men of the expedition, only the French voyagers had previously seen one. Lewis immediately detailed 12 men to accompany him to the site of the kill to bring the carcass back to the river. That night, for the first time, the party dined on buffalo hump, buffalo tongue, buffalo steaks. Next to the tail of the beaver, buffalo hump and tongue at once became the meat of choice. In the Garden of Eden, man had but to reach out for his food. So too on the Great Plains, as Clark's birthday menu demonstrated. But this Garden of Eden was also a potential battlefield populated by numerous Indian tribes containing thousands of warriors. As a result, in addition to being a fabulous field for the botanist and naturalist, the plains were also a challenging field for the soldier, the peacemaker, the ethnologist, and the businessman. These tribes were virtually unknown except to a handful of British and French fur traders. There were many stories and rumors about them, most of all the Sioux, but little solid fact. Jefferson and Lewis had talked at length about these tribes on the basis of near complete ignorance. They speculated that the lost tribe of Israel could be out there on the plains, but it was more likely, in their minds, that the Mandans were a wandering tribe of Welshmen. Because they subscribed to such odd ideas, Jefferson's instructions to Lewis on how to deal with the tribes were, in most particulars, hopelessly naive and impossible to carry out. For example, Jefferson assumed that, although the Sioux were said to be the fiercest and greatest of the tribes, they were very desirous of being on the most friendly terms with us. That bit of wishful thinking led to Jefferson's direct order to Lewis. "On that nation," he commanded, referring to the Sioux, "we wish most particularly to make a favorable impression." In general, Jefferson wanted Lewis to inform the tribes that the new father intended to embrace them into a commercial system that would benefit all involved, and that to make this happen, the new father wished them to make peace with one another. Lewis's objectives, as given to him by Jefferson, were to establish American sovereignty, peace, and a trading empire in which the warriors would put down their weapons and take up traps. Jefferson recognized that the possibility of resistance to this program existed, meaning there was a possibility that the Sioux, or some other unknown tribe, would attempt to stop the expedition. Jefferson knew, too, that Lewis was, like other army officers of his day, extremely sensitive to perceived threats or slights, and he had reason to suspect that Lewis inclined more toward rashness than prudence. That was why Jefferson specifically ordered Lewis to avoid a fight if at all possible. This brought back some realism to the commander-in-chief's orders. Relations with the Indians were important, establishing commercial ties with them was desirable, but the sine qua non of the expedition was to get to the Pacific and return with as much information as possible. Put more bluntly, Lewis's first objective was to get through, and whatever he had to sacrifice to do it would be sacrificed. That was why the standard of discipline was so high, why there was a cannon on a swivel on the bow of the keelboat, and blunderbusses on the stern and on the canoes. Jefferson, Lewis, Clark, everyone involved hoped to God that they would not be needed, but all were prepared to use them if necessary. To avoid fighting and to promote commerce, Lewis had made a major effort to select gifts for the Indians. In Philadelphia in the spring of 1803, and in St. Louis in the winter of 1803-4, he had purchased beads, brass buttons, tomahawks, axes, moccasin awls, scissors, mirrors, and other wonders of the early Industrial Revolution, along with tobacco, vermilion face paint, and whiskey. On Jefferson's direct orders, he had lugged along two corn grinders, presumably to teach the tribes how to make grits. Lewis and Clark scholar James Rhonda puts perspective on the Indian policy of the expedition. These items, everything from ivory combs to calico shirts, represented what the United States offered to potential trading partners. As Jefferson repeated to every delegation of Western Indians, Americans sought commerce, not land. Lewis and Clark were on the road to show American wares. The expedition was the mercantile and hardware display case for a trade empire on the move. Moccasin awls and brass kettles were as much symbols of American power as the medals and flags destined for headmen and warriors. Lewis and Clark, surrounded by bright mirrors and yards of red flannel, offered more than goods. They proposed membership in a system with well-established posts and dependable delivery schedules. The most desired items of all were rifles, balls, and powder. Most of the Indian-held guns on the plains were cheap British shotguns. Lewis wanted to show the overall excellence of the American arms industry, but because of the bulk, he could not carry along free samples. He could demonstrate what his men could do with a Kentucky long rifle, but he could only promise, not deliver, similar weapons for the Indians. The presents, trade goods, certificates, medals, and the rest were packed into 21 bags, each containing a variety of items and each marked for one of the various tribes Lewis expected to encounter before going into winter camp. They began with the Poncas and Omahas, tribes of the lower Missouri, and went on to the Mandans. 5 bales were stuffed with goods for the tribes beyond the Mandans. Thus armed with his orders, guns, and goods, Lewis set out to meet the Indians of the Great Plains. All the tribes of the lower Missouri had been out hunting buffalo as the expedition made its way west and north. It did not encounter a single Indian from St. Charles to pass the Platte River. Then, at sunset on August 2nd, a party of Otoes and a few Missouris arrived at camp, accompanied by a French trader and translator. After an exchange of greetings, the captains gave the Indians some tobacco, twisted together into what was called a carrot after its shape, and some pork, flour, and meal. In return, Clark noted, they sent us watermelons. The Indians said their band of combined Otoes and Missouris numbered 250. They were a farming as well as a hunting people with semi-permanent towns. The captains invited them to a council the next day at their campsite, which they called Council Bluff, across and downriver from present Council Bluffs, Iowa. Clark recorded that he and Lewis also put every man on his guard and ready for anything. The night was a restless one, marked by tension and anticipation instead of sleep. In the morning, the expedition had its first meeting with Indians. Going into it, as James Rhonda points out, the captains had expectations and actions that were deeply rooted in the history of white-red relations in North America, directly linked to generations of forest diplomats. They were preparing for exactly the kind of ritual Clark had seen at the council negotiating the Treaty of Greenville with General Anthony Wayne in 1795. On Friday morning, August 3, 1804, fog hung over the river. As he waited for it to lift and the Indians to come to the council, Lewis wrote out a long speech he intended to make. Clark supervised the preparation of the gifts. The voyagers opened bale number 30 and took out red leggings, fancy dress coats, and blue blankets, along with flags and medals. The sergeants put their squads through a close-order drill, then had some of the men use the mainsail to erect an awning to shield the diplomats from the August sun, while others put in place a flagstaff and ran the stars and stripes up it. By 9 o'clock a.m., the sun had burned off the fog. An hour later, the Indian delegation arrived. The main chief of the Otoes, Little Thief, was away hunting, but 6 or 7 lesser chiefs were present. They joined the captains under the awning. Clark and Lewis were in full dress uniform, complete with cocked hats. The sergeants put the men through a dress parade and passed in review. This must have been the first time the Otoes had seen men march in step, turn as if one, shoulder arms in unison, fire a volley on command, and all the rest that goes into a well-run drill. But how the review impressed the Indians, no member of the expedition thought to record. Lewis then stood to deliver his speech. It was some 2,500 words, so it took him at least half an hour to deliver it, and the translator at least as long to put it into the Oto language. How accurately it was being translated, Lewis, of course, had no way to judge. Nor could he tell how much of what he was saying the Indians could understand, or how much of what they understood they accepted. Lewis opened by advising the warriors to be wise and look to the true interests of their people. "Children," he continued, as Clark recorded his speech, "we have been sent by the great chief of the 17 great nations of America to inform you that a great council was lately held between this great chief and your old fathers, the French and Spaniards." There it was decided that the Missouri River country now belonged to the United States, so that all those who lived in that country, whether white or red, are bound to obey the commands of their great chief, the President, who is now your only great father. In a long, convoluted paragraph, Lewis told the Otoes that the French and Spanish were gone beyond the Great Lake towards the rising sun, from whence they never intend returning to visit their former red children. "Children," Lewis went on, "the President was now your only father. He is the only friend to whom you can now look for protection, or from whom you can ask favors or receive good counsels, and he will take care to serve you and not deceive you." After giving out the good news about this wonderful new father the Otoes had suddenly acquired, Lewis tried to explain the purposes of the expedition. No easy task, since the only white men the Plains Indians had ever seen were traders, whose purpose was obviously to do business. The expedition had more goods than any trader any Indian of the Plains had ever seen, yet the captains did not wish to trade. What on earth were they going to do with all those goods? The Indians had to wonder. "Children," Lewis explained, "the great chief has sent us out to clear the road, remove every obstruction, and to make it the road of peace between himself and his red children residing there, to inquire into the nature of their wants." When the expedition returned home, Lewis would tell the President what the Otoes wanted, and the President would see that those wants were satisfied. Lewis and Clark were advance men and traveling salesmen, in short, representing American business and the American people, whose numbers and skills were all but unlimited. In the 17 great nations of America, Lewis declared, cities are as numerous as the stars of the heavens. What the Americans were doing, Lewis went on, was untainted by any base or self-serving motive. "The great chief has commanded us, his war chiefs, to undertake this long journey, which we have so far accomplished with great labor and much expense, in order to counsel with yourselves and his other red children on the troubled waters, to give you his good advice, to point out to you the road in which you must walk to obtain happiness." As a good father, the President told his children how to behave. They should not block or obstruct in any way the passage of any boat carrying white men, ever. They should make peace with all their neighbors. Now came the threats. Lewis told the Otoes that they must avoid the council of bad men, lest by one false step you should bring upon your nation the displeasure of your great father, who could consume you as the fire consumes the grass of the plains. The great father, if you displease him, would stop all traders from coming up the river. Do as we say, in other words, or no white man will come to you again, ever. That was an extreme threat, strange as it sounds to modern ears. Without contact with European trade goods, the Otoes would suffer a severe setback in their living conditions and would be seriously vulnerable to their neighbors who had access to guns and powder. But if the Otoes did as Lewis advised them, he would see that a trading post was set up at the mouth of the Platte, where they could bring their furs to trade for a store of goods in such quantities as will be equal to your necessities. Meanwhile, their old traders, whether French or British, could stay among them as long as they acknowledged the supremacy of the United States and gave good counsel. In short, after all that talk, Lewis told the Otoes that nothing would be changing in the next year or two. Next came an even bigger embarrassment. Because the expedition had such a long journey ahead of it, and therefore had to carry so many provisions, there were very few presents for the Otoes. That was a flat ending. How Lewis's first oratorical experience went over with his audience cannot be said, although Private Gass recorded in his journal that the announcement about a new father was well received. Clark claimed, "Those people express great satisfaction at the speech delivered." But he also noted that Lewis's speech consisted primarily of some advice to them and directions how they were to conduct themselves, words that would have served well as the title for the speech. When Lewis concluded, the captains distributed presents. They weren't much. Each chief received a breech clout, a bit of paint, and a small medal with a new father's likeness on it, or a comb. The Oto chiefs spoke next. According to Sergeant Ordway, they were very sensible, but Clark was unimpressed. In his opinion, they are no orators. Still, they managed to make their point. The Oto chiefs acknowledged that they had heard what Lewis said, promised to follow his good advice, said they were happy that their new father could be depended on, and concluded by requesting some powder and whiskey. Lewis was eager to please because he wanted Little Thief and some other chiefs to go to Washington in the spring to meet the new father, so he met the request, providing a canister of powder, 50 balls, and a bottle of whiskey. He also shot off his air gun, to the astonishment of the Indians. He ended the council by giving the copy of his speech to one of the chiefs to take back to Little Thief, along with a request that Little Thief come to the river to council. The Indians departed, the expedition proceeded on. At camp that night, on a sandy point on the larboard side, the mosquitoes were excessively troublesome. Private Moses B. Reed told the captains that he had left his knife back at the council site. They gave him permission to go retrieve it, a simple act that illustrated how valuable knives were on the frontier. 3 days later, Reed had not returned. The captains talked it over and concluded that he had deserted. They selected a 4-man detail, headed by Driard, to seek, find, and bring back the deserter Reed with order if he did not give up peaceably to put him to death, etc. The orders were clear and logical and met the situation perfectly. By making the orders a matter of record, the captains absolved Driard and the others in the event they had to kill Reed and took the responsibility for his death onto themselves. The orders also highlighted the fact that the expedition was in a potential war zone and every rifle and paddle was needed. The captains also instructed Driard to attempt to find Little Thief and bring him to camp on the river. Driard was gone 10 days. The captains moved upstream. By August 17th, they were near present-day Sioux City, Iowa. Toward dusk, Private Francis Labiche, one of Driard's party, came into the camp. He reported success. Driard was bringing in Reed and also a delegation of chiefs from the Otoes, including Little Thief. They would arrive in the morning. When Driard came up at about 10 o'clock a.m. on August 18th, the captains gave the Otoes something to eat, then turned to the business immediately at hand, the trial of Private Reed. The court-martial was formed. The charges were read. Reed confessed that he had deserted and stolen a public rifle, shot pouch, powder, and balls. He requested that the captains be as lenient with him as their oaths would allow. His manly behavior seemed to soften the captains. At least they didn't have him shot. Clark recorded that, "We only sentenced him to run the gantlet 4 times through the party and that each man with 9 switches should punish him." That amounted to about 500 lashes well laid on. In addition, Reed was discharged from the permanent party. He had to give up his rifle and the privilege of standing guard. He would work with and be treated as if he were one of the voyagers and would be sent back to St. Louis in the spring. When these results were explained to Little Thief, he and the others petitioned for pardon for this man. Clark and Lewis explained to the chiefs the necessity for the beating. They must have been persuasive, for Clark recorded that the chiefs were all satisfied with the propriety of the sentence and was witness to the punishment. That evening, after eating, the expedition managed to rid itself of the bad taste from the day's principal event. It was Captain Lewis's 30th birthday. To celebrate, an extra dram of whiskey per man went round, and the fiddle came out, and the men danced about the campfire till nearly midnight. In the morning, breakfast. Clark was astonished when one of the chiefs, Big Horse, showed up naked, to emphasize his poverty. After they had eaten, the awning went up and a council was held. Apparently, Lewis read his speech from the copy already held by Little Thief. The chief then asked the captains to act as honest brokers and negotiate a peace between the Otoes and the Omahas. Lewis explained that since the Omahas were out hunting and the expedition must press on, it would be impossible for him to arrange a peace. Then the chief spoke. Big Horse pointed out the obvious, that he had come to the camp naked, and expressed his fear that he would return home naked. Peace was all very well, he said, but if there were peace, where would the young men go to get their goods? If the captains wanted the Otoes at peace, Big Horse pointed out, he could arrange it as long as he had something to give to his young men at home. Whiskey would be the most effective peacemaker. The captains were not going to give Big Horse or any other Indian a barrel of whiskey. They did hand out tobacco, paint, and beads. These gifts made little impression on the chiefs or their warriors. The captains then tried handing around printed certificates proclaiming the bearer to be a friend and ally of the United States. These trifles did not answer either. One disgusted warrior disdainfully handed back his certificate. The captains, angered by this disrespect toward an official document, rebuked the man very roughly. There were bad feelings all around. To dissipate them and to impress the Indians with their powers, the captains gave the chiefs and warriors a dram of whiskey each and brought out their magic show, including the air gun, a magnifying glass that could concentrate the sun's rays to start a fire in a bit of dry grass, the telescope, and other items. But the Otoes had not come to be awed. They had come for goods. They had imagined wonderful giveaways of valuable items from the apparently endless supply on the keelboat, and what they got was some tobacco and a piece of paper. They went away unhappy. Still, Little Thief indicated that he would go to Washington in the spring, so Lewis's and Clark's first venture as frontier diplomats had some success. The Otoes were a tribe that had once been mighty, but were now greatly reduced by the smallpox. Woefully inferior to the Sioux, in morale as well as numbers, they were not the Indians to try to use force to make the captains hand out the goods. With the Sioux, just upriver, things might well be different. Sergeant Charles Floyd had been desperately ill the past few days. Lewis had diagnosed his disease as bilious colic, or bilious colic, and had nothing effective to treat it with. But then neither did Dr. Rush back in Philadelphia. On August 20th, Floyd died, most likely from peritonitis resulting from an infected appendix that had perforated or ruptured. Sergeant Floyd was the first U.S. soldier to die west of the Mississippi. The expedition carried his body to a high, round hill overlooking an unnamed river. The captains had him buried with all the honors of war and fixed a red cedar post over the grave with his name and title and a date. Captain Lewis read the funeral service over him. Clark provided a fitting epitaph in his journal. "This man at all times gave us proofs of his firmness and determined resolution to do service to his country and honor to himself." The captains concluded the proceedings by naming the river Floyd's River and the bluff Sergeant Floyd's Bluff. 2 days and 41 miles later, the captains ordered an election for Floyd's replacement. Private Patrick Gass got 19 votes, while Privates William Bratton and George Gibson split the remainder. This was the first election ever held west of the Mississippi. On August 26th, Lewis issued general orders appointing Patrick Gass to the rank of Sergeant in the Corps of Volunteer for Northwestern Discovery, the first time he used such a phrase. He praised Gass for his previous faithful service and concluded, "The commanding officers are still further confirmed in the high opinion they had previously formed of the capacity, diligence, and integrity of Sergeant Gass, from the wish expressed by a large majority of his comrades for his appointment as sergeant." That same day, Private George Shannon, youngest member of the party, failed to come up after a day of hunting. Nor did he report in the next day or the day after. The captains grew concerned, not about desertion — evidently Shannon gave them no uneasiness on that score — but about possible Indian trouble or a hunting accident. They sent Private John Coulter out looking for Shannon, but he had no luck. They sent Driard to look, but after searching through the night of August 26th to 27th, he too reported failure. Reed dismissed in disgrace. Sergeant Floyd dead. Shannon missing. The expedition was almost 10% reduced in fighting strength as it moved toward the heart of Sioux territory. But hope, rather than fear, was the main emotion felt by the captains as they entered Sioux country. This was the one tribe singled out for specific mention by Jefferson in his orders. It controlled the river and had turned back previous traders coming up from St. Louis, and it was the largest of the tribes. Lewis hoped to make the Sioux the centerpiece of the vast American trading empire he was trying to establish, and he thought this was such a good deal for the Sioux that they couldn't say no. On August 27th, as the keelboat approached today's Yankton, South Dakota, Old Dorion informed the captains that they were now in the territory of the Yankton Sioux, with whom he had lived for many years. Lewis ordered the prairie set afire as a signal to the Yanktons, inviting them to a council. A few hours later, as the boat passed the mouth of the James River, a teenage Yankton boy swam out to one of the pirogues. He gestured that he wished to talk. The expedition put ashore. Two more teenagers appeared. Through Mr. Dorion, they said a large band of Yanktons were camped nearby. The captains delegated Sergeant Pryor, a voyager, and Mr. Dorion to go to the camp and invite the chiefs to come to council at Calumet Bluffs, near present Gavin's Point Dam on the Nebraska side. On August 29th, the expedition was in camp at Calumet Bluffs. As they waited for the Yanktons to come to council, they worked. Tracks along the riverbank had led Lewis to conclude that Shannon was ahead of them, but thinking himself behind, so Shannon was pressing on to catch up to the expedition that was behind him. Lewis detailed a soldier to go look for Shannon. Reflecting his worry, Lewis told the private to take along some extra rations for Shannon, who might well be starving. He was not considered to be one of the expedition's better hunters. Captain Clark put some men to work making a tow rope of elk skin, then sat at his field desk, dipped his quill into the inkstand, and began to write some remarks for the Yanktons. At 4 o'clock p.m., Mr. Dorion showed up on the opposite bank at the head of a party of some 70 Yankton warriors. The Indians went into camp, while Dorion and Sergeant Pryor crossed over on a canoe sent by the captains. Pryor reported that the Yanktons were extremely friendly, had even tried to carry him into their camp on a painted buffalo robe, thinking he was the leader of the expedition. He said the camp was handsome, made of buffalo skins painted different color, all compact and handsomely arranged. Their camps formed of a conic form, containing about 12 or 15 persons each, and 40 in number. Sergeant Pryor had just become the first American to describe the classic Plains teepee. The Yanktons had cooked a fat dog for a feast. Pryor thought it good and well-flavored. They had provided him with a snug apartment for to lodge. The plains through which he had marched, Pryor said, were covered with game. The captains had presents packed into one of the canoes to send over to the Yanktons. They put in tobacco, corn, and some iron kettles, and told Pryor and Dorion to ask the Indians to cross over in the morning for a council. At 10 o'clock a.m., the captain sent a canoe to bring over the Indians. They had signified the importance of this first meeting with one of the Sioux bands by putting on their dress uniforms and putting up a flagstaff near a large oak, running up the flag, and firing the bow swivel gun. The Yanktons had a sense of drama, too. They were in full regalia. As they came up from the riverbank, the chiefs were preceded by four musicians, singing and playing as they made their way to the flagstaff. The soldiers made ritual payments of tobacco to the musicians. The conferees shook hands and sat down. With Dorion interpreting, Lewis gave his basic Indian speech. When he finished, the chief said they would respond in the morning. Obviously, they would need time to confer on this business of accepting a new father and becoming part of a new trade system. Lewis recognized that patience was not just a virtue in dealing with Indians, it was a necessity, and handed out medals to five chiefs. He pronounced a chief named Wiuchi the first chief, by what authority, on what basis, cannot be said, and gave him a red-laced military coat, a military cocked hat, and an American flag. Lewis did all this with the utmost seriousness. It never occurred to him that his actions might be characterized as patronizing, dictatorial, ridiculous, and highly dangerous. From what he knew from old Dorian, these Yanktons were peaceable, at least compared with their neighbors and relatives, the Teton Sioux, farther upriver. But his idea of how to make them into allies was to give them worthless medals and wardrobe trappings rather than the guns and powder they needed. And to make one chief the big chief was to meddle in intertribal politics about which he knew nothing. In general, it would be impossible to say which side was more ignorant of the other. The desire for friendship overrode ignorance. The men of the expedition had come to the northern plains as outsiders, but as James Rhonda writes, that night the explorers became part of a prairie community. After the council, Indian boys showed off their skill with bows and arrows, to the delight of the soldiers, who handed out prizes of beads. At dusk, three fires were built in the center of camp. Indians in gaudy paint came leaping into the firelight to sing of their great feats in battle and in the chase. They danced to music coming from deer hoof rattles and a drum. Sergeant Ordway recorded that the warriors began with a whoop and hollow and ended with the same. An individual would sing of what he had done in his day and what warlike actions he had done. This they call merit. They would confess how many horses they had stole. At Dorian's suggestion, the soldiers threw the dancers gifts of tobacco, knives, and bells. Captain Clark was impressed. "The Sioux," he wrote, "is a stout, bold-looking people, the young men handsome, and well-made. The warriors are very much decorated with pain, porcupine, quills, and feathers, large leggings and moccasins, all with buffalo robes of different colors. The squaws wore petticoats and white buffalo robes with the black hair turned back over their necks and shoulders." That was the first American description of the ceremonial dress of the Plains Indians. The captains were doing path-breaking ethnology. Clark wrote, "I will here remark a society which I had never before this day heard was in any nation of Indians." It was a group of Indian warriors who had taken a vow, never to give back, let the danger be what it may. That refusal to retreat had cost the society dreadfully. In the past year, 18 of the 22 members had been killed. Clark was impressed by the survivors. "They stay by themselves, fond of mirth and assume a degree of superiority. Stout, likely fellows." Ethnology, however, was very much secondary to establishing the American system along the Missouri. What the Indians looked like was entertaining. What the chief said about Lewis's proposals was critical. In the morning, the chiefs gave their reply. Wiuchi spoke first. His refrain was, "We are poor and have no powder and ball. Our women has got no clothes." But if Mr. Dorian were with him, he would go to Washington in the spring. Welcome news. The other chiefs then spoke. They suffered from stage fright. "I am young and can't speak," struck by the panna confessed. "I am a young man and inexperienced, cannot say much," White Crane Man explained. But they all managed to make it clear that what they wanted was powder and ball, and perhaps some whiskey. Clark and Lewis could not meet those needs. They could do one thing all the chiefs wanted, leave Mr. Dorian with them for the winter. He could arrange peace with other tribes and organize an expedition of chiefs to go to Washington in the spring. The captains gave each chief a carrot of tobacco and Mr. Dorian a bottle of whiskey and had the Indians ferried across the river to their camp on the other side. Thus, the first encounter with the band of Sioux ended on a hopeful note, despite Yankton disappointment with the presents received. The last chief to speak, Arkawichar, had also apologized. "I do not speak very well. I am a poor man." But if he did not speak well, he spoke with the voice of a prophet. It was all very well for the Yanktons to open their ears, he said, "and I think our old friend Mr. Dorian can open the ears of the other bands of Sioux. But I fear those nations above will not open their ears, and you cannot, I fear, open them." Arkawichar spoke not only prophetically, but bluntly. He said the captains had given the Indians 5 medals. "I wish you to give 5 kegs of powder with them." The captains did not, could not comply. As Arkawichar had warned them, where they were going, they would need all their powder. Chapter 14. Encounter with the Sioux, September 1804. In the first 2 weeks of September, the expedition gradually entered the country where the short grass prairie of the drier high plains predominated. The wildlife became even more abundant than below. There were herds of elk in every copse of woods along the riverbank. Deer were as plentiful as birds. Buffalo became a common sight. The men pointed out a goat which no one could identify, but no one could catch either. Captain Clark pronounced the plums the most delicious he had ever tasted, the grapes plenty and finely flavored. On the third, the captain sent Coulter to chase Shannon again. 2 days later, tracks along the riverbank indicated that Coulter was still trying to catch up and that Shannon had lost one of the two horses he had with him. Private John Shields came in from a hunt to report another wonder, a deer with a black tail. Lewis saw more wild goats on a hill, but they ran off before he could even describe their color. The hunters brought in 3 bucks and 2 elk. Moving the keelboat and pirogues upriver required a tremendous effort from each man. Consequently, they ate prodigiously. In comparison with beef, the venison and elk were lean, even at this season. Each soldier consumed up to 9 pounds of meat per day, along with whatever fruit the area afforded, and some cornmeal, and still felt hungry. On September 7th, in present Boyd County, Nebraska, the captains took a stroll. To their astonishment, they found themselves in the middle of an extensive village of small mammals that lived in tunnels in the ground. Here, there, everywhere around them, the little mammals would pop up, sit up on their hind legs, and chatter. The captains brought some men to the site and tried to dig to the bottom of one of the tunnels, but after digging 6 feet and running a pole down the rest, they discovered they were not halfway to the animal's bed. They had 5 barrels of water fetched to the site and poured into a tunnel, which forced one animal out. He was killed and brought back to the keelboat so that a proper description could be written. The voyagers informed the captains that these animals were petit chien, or prairie dogs. The animal was new to science. The captains gave the prairie dog his first formal description. On September 8th, Clark went ashore to look for goats, with no success. Lewis went hunting, and on that day killed his first buffalo. Altogether, the hunters brought in that evening 2 buffalo, 1 large elk, 1 elk fawn, 3 deer, 3 wild turkeys, and a squirrel. The following day, Lewis again went hunting, this time with Private Reuben Field along, and shot another buffalo. Field got one too, as did Clark. Driard killed 3 deer. York killed a buffalo at the invitation of his master. The captains were amazed to see 500 buffalo in one herd grazing near the river. On September 11th, as the keelboat moved past a bend in the river, the bowman spotted Shannon sitting by the bank. The keelboat came to and Shannon came aboard. He was extremely weak, indeed nearly starved to death. As his comrades gave him jerked meat, he related his story. He had been sure the boat was ahead, so he had been chasing it for 16 days. For the past 12 days, he had been without bullets. During that time, he had managed to kill 1 rabbit by shooting a long, hard, straight stick in place of a bullet. Otherwise, he had lived for nearly 2 weeks on grapes and plums. He had finally concluded that he was too weak ever to catch up with the keelboat and had decided to sit by the riverbank and hope for a trading boat coming down from the Mandan villages headed toward St. Louis. He had saved his horse as his last resort. Clark was astounded that a man had liked to have starved to death in a land of plenty for the want of bullets or something to kill his meat. On the 14th, Clark killed a goat. Lewis weighed, measured, and described it, the first scientific description of the pronghorn, or antelope, as it is usually but wrongly called. That afternoon, Private Shields brought in a hare of the prairie, giving Lewis a second opportunity in a single day to measure and describe a new species, in this case, the white-tailed jackrabbit. Intrigued by the animal, Lewis went looking for the jackrabbit in its native habitat a couple of days later. He found one, chased it, and made notes. It resorts to the open plains, is extremely fleet, and never burrows or takes shelter in the ground when pursued. I measured the leaps of one which I surprised in the plains, and found them 21 feet. They appear to run with more ease and to bound with greater agility than any animal I ever saw. That is one of three Lewis documents written between September 14th and 17th, 1804. They constitute almost all of his known writings for a full year. This adds to the mystery of the lost, or never written, journals of Meriwether Lewis. The passage quoted above comes from Lewis's field notes, which exist but in an obviously incomplete form. All his celestial measurements, hundreds and hundreds of them, are preserved. But there are only two journal entries, one on the 16th and the next on the 17th of September, 1804. The way they are written indicates that he almost had to have been writing regularly. There is no introduction, no "sorry I've been away, here is what has happened since last I wrote" quality whatsoever to the entries. He picks up, apparently, at where he left off the previous evening, and gives every sense at the conclusion of his second entry that more will follow in the morning. But until new journal entries are discovered, their existence remains speculative. Writing as a biographer rather than an archivist or a historian, that is, on the basis of the internal evidence of the September entries, I am convinced that there once existed, and still may, an important body of Lewis journal entries. The pain of the loss is doubled by the quality of what Lewis wrote that September. He walks you through his day and lets you see through his eyes. What he saw, no American had ever seen before, and only a few would see in the future. This morning set out at an early hour. Lewis opened the entry for Sunday, September 16th. Come to at 1:30 after 7 a.m. on the Lard. Shore 1¼ miles above the mouth of a small creek which we named Corvus, in consequence of having killed a beautiful bird of that genus near it. The captains decided to lie by for 2 days, to dry the baggage and to lighten the keelboat by transferring a part of her load.